This is Washington Today for the 20th of July, 2021. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba with some of today's headlines. The bipartisan infrastructure deal senators brokered with President Joe Biden is facing a crucial Wednesday test vote as senators struggle over how to pay for nearly $1 trillion in public works spending. Tensions were rising Tuesday as Republicans prepared to block the vote, mounting a filibuster over what they see as a rushed and misguided process. With President Biden preparing to hit the road to rally support for his big infrastructure ideas, including some $3.5 trillion in a follow-up bill, some Democrats say it's time to at least start debate on this first phase of his proposals. Politico's Caitlin Emma will provide the latest updates in a moment. Meanwhile, a fully vaccinated White House aide has tested positive for COVID-19. That's according to White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. That's what she told reporters today. Several vaccinated congressional staffers and a member of Congress also tested positive. The Office of the Attending Physician at the Capitol made that announcement earlier today. We'll have more on mask mandates and the Delta variant with the Washington Post's Dan Diamond coming up. And Jeff Bezos, the world's richest man, soared about 66.5 miles above the Texas desert aboard his company Blue Origin's New Shepard launch vehicle that took place this morning, and they returned safely to Earth. We begin now on Capitol Hill at a Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee hearing. Centers for Disease Control Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky told committee members that the Delta variant is responsible for 83% of all new COVID-19 cases. Dr. Anthony Fauci also testified and responded to questions about the National Institutes of Health funding research in Wuhan and the origins of the coronavirus. Here's Dr. Fauci with opening remarks on the Delta variant.
The sobering news that you've already heard of is the fact that we are now challenged with a very difficult and problematic variant referred to as the Delta variant. It has now been detected in at least 90-plus countries throughout the world. The reason it's so formidable is the fact that it has the capability of transmitting efficiently from human to human in an extraordinary manner, well beyond any of the other variants that we've experienced up to now, which has led to its becoming the dominant variant in this country. When I spoke to you last time, it was about 1 to 3% of the variants in the population. Right now, it's gone to over 80%, and in some regions of the country, as high as 90%. That is the troubling news. The fact is that, however, and the importance of vaccination, is that our vaccines that we're using in this country are very effective against this variant, particularly, I point out, to the situation regarding advanced disease leading to hospitalizations and deaths, where it's still well in the 90% of effectiveness. I'd like to close with just one or two comments that we've been hearing about regarding the situation of booster or an additional third dose superimposed upon the double doses of the mRNA and the single dose of the J&J. Right now, we are doing studies to determine whether or not we will need boosters to increase the durability of protection. We don't want people to believe that when you're talking about boosters, that means that the vaccines are not effective. They are highly effective. We're talking about the durability of that, and we're doing studies now to determine that. In addition, there are individuals who are immunosuppressed, people who are on cancer chemotherapy, a variety of other individuals, transplant individuals, who may actually need a boost as part of their initial regimen in the sense of getting them up to the point where they are protected. So in closing, I want to underscore what Dr. Walensky just said a few moments ago, the extraordinary importance of getting as many people vaccinated as we possibly can. We have the tools to end this epidemic. It is up to us to utilize those tools to their maximum.
Dr. Anthony Fauci earlier on Capitol Hill. Deaths from COVID-19 in the United States have averaged 239 per day over the past week, nearly 48% higher than the previous week. That's what CDC Director Rochelle Walensky said during this hearing. Colorado Democrat Senator John Hickenlooper questioned Dr. Walensky. Here's what she had to say about opening schools.
We saw yesterday the Pediatrics Academy talk about kids older than two wearing masks. We know that kids 12 and older should be getting vaccinated. Just quickly, to give you a platform to talk about that unified message, what should schools be thinking about, and who should they be talking to get ready? Obviously, the more kids we can get that are over 12 and older, the more we get them vaccinated, they will be fully protected by the time they get to school in the fall. If we start now, what does that message look like? Would be a couple of Dr. Walensky, why don't you start, and then Dr. Fauci can fill in.
Thank you for that question, Senator. First of all, I want to lean in and say I think it's critically important that our schools be open for full in-person learning in the fall. We have learned enough over the last year to understand what we need to do to keep our children safe, and we believe, based on the science, that we can keep them safe in those settings. How are we going to keep them safe? The first and foremost is the best thing would be to have everybody vaccinated who can be vaccinated. Surround unvaccinated children who are not yet eligible with people who are vaccinated to protect them. So that is the highest and most important thing. For those children who are not able to be vaccinated, they can and should wear a mask in those school settings, and we have said that in our guidance. I want to also comment on one other thing, and that I think is critically important in the school year coming ahead, and that is the role of testing. Senator Burr has talked about the importance of other viral syndromes, flu, influenza. We are going to see upper respiratory infections in these schools in the fall. These kids have not been in school. They have not been with each other. And I'm worried about the upper respiratory infections. And we are going to have to understand what is COVID and what is a simple cold among children. So those are among the things that I'm thinking about. Thank you.
CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky from earlier today. Now, at times, the hearing got heated, especially during questioning from Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, to Dr. Anthony Fauci. Senator Paul questioned Dr. Fauci on his previous remarks before the Senate about the origins of COVID-19. Here's that exchange.
Dr. Fauci, knowing that it is a crime to lie to Congress, do you wish to retract your statement of May 11th where you claimed that the NIH never funded gain-of-function research in Wuhan?
Your microphone.
Senator Paul, I have never lied before the Congress, and I do not retract that statement. This paper that you are referring to was judged by qualified staff up and down the chain as not being gain of function.
You take an animal virus and you increase its transmissibility to humans,
right.
You're saying that's not gain of function?
Yeah, that is correct. And Senator Paul, you do not know what you are talking about, quite frankly. And I want to say that officially. You do not know what you are talking about.
Let's read from the NIH definition of gain of function. This is your definition that you guys wrote. It says that scientific research that increases the transmissibility among mammals is gain of function. They took animal viruses that only occur in animals, and they increased their transmissibility to humans. How you can say that is not gain of function?
It is not.
It's a dance, and you're dancing around this because you're trying to obscure responsibility for 4 million people dying around the world from a pandemic.
And let's send Dr. Fauci.
Now you're getting into something. If the point that you are making is that the grant that was funded as a sub-award from EcoHealth to Wuhan created SARS-CoV-2. That's where you are getting. Let me finish.
We don't know.
Wait a minute.
The evidence is pointing that it came from the lab, and there will be responsibility for those who funded the lab, including yourself. I totally
resent the lie that you are now propagating, Senator, because if you look at the viruses that were used in the experiments that were given in the annual reports that were published in the literature, it is molecularly impossible.
No one's saying those viruses caused it. Those viruses caused the pandemic. What we're alleging is that gain-of-function research was going on in that lab, and NIH funded it.
You can't
get away from it. It meets your definition, and you are obfuscating the truth.
I'm not obfuscating the truth.
Senator Paul's time has expired, but I will allow the witness to
finish. Let me just finish. I want everyone to understand that if you look at those viruses, and that's judged by qualified virologists and evolutionary biologists, Those viruses are molecularly impossible to result in SARS-CoV-2.
No one's saying those viruses caused the pandemic. We're saying they are gain-of-function viruses because they were animal viruses that became more transmissible in human, and you funded it.
And you
admit the truth.
And you implying...
Senator Paul, your time has expired, and I will allow witnesses who come before this committee to respond.
And you are implying that what we did was responsible for the deaths of individuals. I totally resent that. And if anybody is lying here, Senator, it is you.
That exchange between Dr. Anthony Fauci and Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul from Tuesday's hearing. In a memo to Capitol Hill staff sent this morning, attending physician Brian Monahan wrote that, quote, several vaccinated congressional staff members and one member of Congress have tested positive for COVID-19 via breakthrough infection. Monahan stopped short of calling for a mask mandate, but said, quote, individuals have the personal discretion to wear a mask and future developments in the coronavirus Delta variant local threat may require the resumption of mask wearing for all, as now seen in several counties, end quote. The cases come as a senior official at the White House also tested positive for COVID. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, on COVID cases on Capitol Hill and the importance of vaccines.
There, the Republican governor of Utah said this weekend that conservative talking heads are, quote, literally killing their supporters. Would you speak out against people who are actually speaking out against the vaccine?
I don't know how I could be any more clear than I have been. I've been saying the same thing about vaccinations all along the way. Others can say whatever they choose to say, but this is something I think I'm a good example of, something I know the answer to. It is not at all unclear that the way to avoid getting back in the hospital is to get vaccinated. I want to encourage everybody to do that and to ignore all of these other voices that are giving demonstrably bad advice.
Mask mandates make a return along with controversy. That's the headline at the Washington Post by National Health reporter Dan Diamond. What is that controversy?
The controversy is that many Americans felt like this was in the past, that masks were behind us. There were even performative burnings of masks. So 2 months after the CDC said that mask guidance could be rolled back, now there are local health officers around the country saying either masks are recommended again or even required when you're indoors given the spread of coronavirus, specifically this new Delta variant.
But are there some inconsistencies and questionable guidance coming from health experts in the past couple of weeks?
There has been a difference of opinion about whether, say, masks are needed. The CDC had said in May, if you're vaccinated, you don't need a mask in most settings. Unfortunately, a lot of people heard that message and thought it meant nobody needs a mask. So I think there was some messaging challenge where a lot of unvaccinated Americans took away a message that the CDC was not intending. I do think we are in a bit of misalignment, though, where local health experts might be recommending that people wear masks again, and the CDC is still holding off. And those sorts of gaps between the federal level and the state level can create confusion and misinformation, especially for people who don't know what to do.
And what are health experts doing to address that confusion?
Well, I think at the moment, they're still trying to figure out exactly what the right message should be. So in California, where Los Angeles County has required residents to start wearing masks indoors again, local health officials there have been very proactive in trying to spread the message. They've communicated with businesses. They've enlisted politicians. At the same time, there's been a critical reaction to this. Republicans in Southern California say they don't want to go along with this. A Republican who's trying to bid for the governor's seat, Kevin Faulkner, the former San Diego mayor, has critiqued this measure. He said if he gets elected governor, he would never go for this sort of thing. The Los Angeles County Sheriff said he won't enforce this local mandate. So there is a lot of tension, even in this one county. If you look at this county as a microcosm of what could happen if more counties follow suit and try and recommend that mandates come back.
And this quote from the WashingtonPost.com in your article, in a free country, people will evaluate their personal risk factors and are smart enough to ultimately make medical decisions like wearing a mask themselves. That's from Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky. And in that statement last week, as you wrote in your article, says that ban, introducing legislation that would ban mask mandates on planes and public transportation. What do you see among the experts that you're talking to with regards to this proposal?
I have to be honest. The experts I talked to made me worried. They talked about the risks of Delta variant, how easy it is to spread, how there's increasing evidence that it can spread very, very quickly if you're not masked, if you're not taking suitable protections. And there are increased cases of what are known as breakthrough infections. So people who are vaccinated but getting sick regardless. I think that we are at a moment where the science is still trying to catch up with the public health guidance. And we will see in the days and weeks ahead, the CDC likely offering new instruction on what we need to do as the Delta variant takes hold across the country. In the meantime, public health experts are recommending many of the same things we've heard for a year and a half. If you are putting yourself in a position where there might be a big crowd, wear a mask. If you know that you've been exposed to someone who had coronavirus, stay home, get tested. And the hope is that we can get through this next period without significant measures that put us back where we were last year.
And we are at, according to Dan Diamond, national health reporter for the WashingtonPost.com, the daily average of confirmed U.S. coronavirus cases has nearly tripled in the past month, from fewer than 12,000 on June 19th to almost 35,000 on Monday.
Yeah, I mean, those numbers are not great, right, Lee? The cases are still well below where they were at the peak, which was back in January 2021. There were 250,000 new cases per day. There were several thousand deaths per day. We were at a fraction of that. We're at maybe 35,000 cases per day at this point and several hundred deaths. Still not great. I mean, those are terrible numbers in the abstract, but compared to where we were, we have come to a much better place. The challenge is that the trend is now turning rapidly in the other direction. Things looked a lot better 3 weeks ago than they do now. And we know that with the Delta variant, it can spread so fast that people who have only passing exposure to someone who's infected may get the coronavirus too. There's also a good chance that we're undercounting how many people have been infected, because if you're vaccinated and you get the Delta variant, and this is in many ways a good thing, you might not even know it. You might not have symptoms. The vaccine protects you, but you still may be able to transmit the virus to other people, even if you're vaccinated. So the numbers may actually be higher than where they are. A lot of good progress from where we were earlier this year, but some very bad signs in the past few weeks.
So those who you have been speaking with, what are they doing to keep safe?
I talked to one expert, Lindsay Marr, an engineer at Virginia Tech. She told me that if she goes to see a movie, she's wearing a good mask, a proven mask in the movie theater. I talked to Kim Prather, an expert out at UC San Diego. She told me that she's starting to wear masks again, even outside, which she said, you know, I know that sounds like a lot, but based on what she has heard about how coronavirus with the Delta variant can spread in crowds outside, she's trying to take every precaution to not get sick. I'll just say for myself, this has given me new thought about the need to wear masks again. I've started going back into buildings without masks. I think I personally will start wearing a mask for the near future when I'm indoors.
WashingtonPost.com national health reporter Dan Diamond, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Washington Today. The Senate's bipartisan infrastructure negotiators are working to finish their bill as Republicans push for Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer to reschedule a Wednesday test vote that's likely to fail. The bipartisan group was scheduled to meet Tuesday afternoon after a two-hour Zoom session Monday night with the White House. Though participants reported progress on that call, some of the groups say the talks are likely to drag into next week. Given the size and scale of both the potential bill with nearly $600 billion in new spending, as well as disagreements over how to pay for it. Here's Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer from earlier.
Yes.
Senator Schumer, what do you say to Senate Republicans who are saying that you're trying to kill the bipartisan deal by holding a vote that's likely to fail tomorrow?
Well, look, there's no reason it should fail. Ask them, what is the reason? They say they need the whole bill text. They haven't asked for that on bill after bill after bill. We have the plan that I have is very fair to the bipartisan process. First, move forward on the shell bill. That's just a motion to proceed, just to debate it. Then, if by tomorrow the bipartisan bill is ready, or even if the outline is ready, we'll go forward and put that bill on the floor. And if not, we'll put something together that just about every Republican voted for that deals with the infrastructure that is bipartisan. What could be wrong with that? We never, almost never, wait on a complex bill like this for the full bill to be put on the floor to be debated. So we're moving forward, and we hope our Republican friends will decide they want to move forward as well. Yes? Look, we hope that our Republican friends vote yes tomorrow. That's what they should be doing if they believe in a bipartisan bill. There's no reason why they shouldn't. Yes?
Yes. Senator Graham has said that Republicans should consider leaving town to deny quorum to Democrats in order to debate.
That speaks for itself. Yes, you're the last one.
Will you move to the budget reconciliation process if this vote fails?
Look, we want to get both the bipartisan bill done and the budget reconciliation process done, and we're hopeful that our Republican colleagues will realize that the best way to do that is voting yes on the motion to proceed on the shell bill so we can finally, after a month of negotiations, begin debating a bipartisan infrastructure bill. Thanks, everybody.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer with reporters earlier today. Now, according to an article in Politico, Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine and one of the GOP negotiators, is pushing for the vote to be delayed until Monday and added that a failed vote on Wednesday, quote, certainly is not helpful, end quote. Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican of Louisiana, said the bipartisan group needed to discuss Schumer's remarks on Tuesday before he could say how he will vote on Wednesday. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell earlier speaking with reporters about that bill.
Democrats say that it's not them that's trying to kill the bipartisan infrastructure bill, but Republicans by not voting on this motion to proceed tomorrow, pointing to the fact that it's been done many times. So what is your response? Are Republicans, are you wanting this bill to die?
Senator Blunt covered that. The Majority Leader will not be slowed down by having this motion to proceed to the bill defeated. All that does is give him the opportunity to move to reconsider, and at whatever point the bipartisan deal comes together, we can reconsider the vote, and then he'd have the option to lay that down as a substitute. In other words, no time is lost by adhering to a very simple principle. We're not going to the bill until we know what the bill is.
This headline from Politico.com, Senate negotiators race to finish infrastructure bill as failed vote looms. We hear now from Caitlin Emma, budget and appropriations reporter for Politico, speaking to us from Capitol Hill. What's at issue right now?
So we essentially have these a Wednesday deadline on these two packages. One is a bipartisan infrastructure package that a sort of group of, you know, Senate negotiators are working to finish up and clinch a compromise as, you know, fast as they can, because Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has set up a sort of a key procedural vote on Wednesday in order to basically like hustle them along. But we're seeing a lot of Republican opposition to that. A lot of Republicans are saying, don't rush the process. You know, we're still negotiating. We're going to get there. You know, don't force us to take this procedural vote, which essentially is just a symbolic way of moving forward on a package that they haven't even finalized yet. And then separately, Senate Democrats are trying to get all 50 of their members on board with a $3.5 trillion reconciliation package, which they hope to pass without Republican support. And, you know, this is a big, big vehicle for all of President Biden's priorities, all of his sort of so-called human infrastructure priorities and investments in the middle class and families. But they need to get folks like, for example, Senator Joe Manchin on board You know, he said he has some concerns about inflation and how much money we're spending and some of the climate provisions there. So Senate Democrats are really working to get everybody on the same page with this separate effort.
And speaking of price tag, is that the main issue standing in the way?
So on the $3.5 trillion bill that Democrats want to move without Republicans, Senator Manchin has said he's concerned about inflation. So he's concerned that, you know, if Congress passes a package that this large, that it might make something like inflation worse. You know, there are senators who wanted to spend more than $3.5 trillion. Senator Bernie Sanders, for example, wanted to go as high as $6 trillion. So the top line figure there, you know, kind of represents an agreement among members of the Senate Budget Committee. All those Democrats were able to agree on $3.5 trillion. And now they need to get the rest of the caucus kind of on board with the general framework for what flows from that $3.5 trillion. And on the separate bipartisan infrastructure package, that would provide about like $600 billion in new spending. But the overall total for the package is really not what has been causing issues here. Republicans are concerned about ways to pay for this package. And there's been a lot of fighting in recent days over, you know, how exactly to ensure that this package doesn't add to the federal debt. And sometimes those pay-fors, so-called pay-fors, are pretty straight up, and sometimes they're a little more creative. But, you know, for the most part, negotiators are still trying to figure out, you know, how exactly they say they want to pay for this package so that they can move forward on a bipartisan agreement.
There's been debate among politicos that Senate Democrats should take the bipartisan infrastructure bill on alone. But according to experts, I've been hearing the term uphill battle. What should we look for tomorrow?
I think what we need to look for tomorrow is, at least at this stage, it seems like Senate Republicans are set to defeat this procedural vote that Schumer wants to take in order to sort of hustle things along. So what happens if that fails? I guess you need to sort of pay attention to just sort of the future and the prospects of coming up with a bipartisan deal. You know, can this group come to an agreement? Can they really finish their work on this and ensure that they can get something that can pass like the entire upper chamber? So you need at least 10 Senate Republicans to vote on this in addition to every single Democrat. So really we need to see if this failed procedural vote and in the coming days these negotiations sort of fall apart. And if that happens, does that then change what Democrats want to put in their one-party $3.5 trillion bill? You know, if there are pieces of that bipartisan infrastructure package that just fall by the wayside, do they end up in a reconciliation bill? And does that change the overall amount that Democrats want to spend? So sort of both of these bills are inextricably linked, and you know, they kind of depend on each other, one another, for success in some ways.
So taking this to Main Street, is the general public understanding these bills, the process, and are they supporting them?
If I had to guess, I don't know that the general public is very tuned into the process by which, you know, Congress is looking to pass these bills. I mean, one of these bills, the bipartisan bill, is sort of going through what's known as regular order. You know, you would get 10 Senate Republicans on board. You would get at least 10 Senate Republicans on board in order to move this thing through the Senate and then send it over to the House. But on the $3.5 trillion package, they're using something called the budget reconciliation process. And this is a privileged process that Democrats can use to pass a huge, you know, piece of legislation that affects revenues and federal spending without Republican support. And it's this very tricky, like, morass of, you know, budget rules that people have to follow. And it's a very complicated process. So I think what's really translating maybe to the mainstream is that, you know, the president is very serious about making an investment in infrastructure one way or another. And Democrats are very serious about making investments in the middle class and families. And, you know, one way or another, the Democratic Party is trying to do this, you know, with or without Republican support.
Budget and appropriations reporter for Politico, Caitlin Emma, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Washington Today for Tuesday, July 20th, 2021. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Here are a few more headlines. The chair of former President Donald Trump's 2017 inaugural committee was arrested earlier today on charges alleging that he and others conspired to influence Trump's foreign policy positions to benefit the United Arab Emirates. Thomas Barrick was among three men charged in New York federal court with trying to influence foreign policy while former President Trump was running in 2016 and then later while he was president. Prompted by Britney Spears' conservatorship fight, a bipartisan legislative effort has emerged to reform the process created to protect the rights of more than 1 million people across the United States under the protective arrangements. And on Tuesday, Representatives Charlie Crist and Nancy Mace unveiled the Free Britney Act, designed to give more options to people placed under conservatorships. Those include the ability to talk about their situations with caseworkers over any objections from their conservators and petition a court to replace their conservators without having to, quote, prove wrongdoing or malfeasance. Senate Minority Leader McCarthy announced he selected Republican Study Committee Chairman Jim Banks of Indiana to lead Republicans on the panel and House Administration Ranking Member Rodney Davis of Illinois. House Judiciary Ranking Member Jim Jordan of Ohio, Representative Kelly Armstrong of North Dakota, and Representative Troy Nails of Texas to serve on the committee. Three of Leader McCarthy's picks, Representative Banks, Jordan, and Nails, voted against certifying the election results. But Speaker Pelosi said that she is not taking GOP lawmakers objecting to the vote into account while making her decision. Speaker Nancy Pelosi has not ruled out vetoing House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy's selections to serve on the January 6th Select Committee. Here she is speaking with CNN's Manu Raju earlier today while walking in Statuary Hall.
I'm not prepared to make a statement on that, but I'm considering his proposals.
You're considering it? You haven't made
a final... No, considering his proposals.
Have you made a final...
I'd like to be clear about how people voted on the president affirming the election of Joe Biden is not a criterion for service.
What is
that
the
doesn't matter. No.
What is the criterion?
Well, you'll find out when we're making it.
Do you plan to make that decision today?
When I'm ready.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi earlier today. House Minority Whip Steve Scalise, Republican of Louisiana, responded to questions about his leader's pick for the committee. Here's what he had to say during a press conference earlier.
Kevin McCarthy named his members to the January 6th Select Committee. In your view, what should their mission be? And do you think Speaker Nancy Pelosi should testify about security in the Capitol that day?
Well, there have been many questions raised about why there wasn't a higher National Guard presence. It was supposedly offered. At what level was that rejected? I would hope they would look into that because that question really hasn't been answered. How high up the chain did it go? Was it at the speaker's level where they were offered National Guard protection on January 6th and denied it? But I know Leader McCarthy's been very vocal about this, as many of us have, that they need to look at the whole array of political violence that led up to January 6th and still has gone on after that. There was a Capitol Police officer killed after January 6th that Speaker Pelosi doesn't want to look into that seems to be motivated by political violence. So let's look at the whole array of political violence and what we can do to dial that down and get better control over it. So I hope they would look at that. Well, who they call and testify, let the members of the committee discuss that and debate that. But that answer to that question is one of many questions that's unanswered, and that is at what level from the Speaker's office on down did they reject the offer for help from the National Guard?
Republican Whip Steve Scalise from earlier. The Select Committee, which was approved largely along party lines in June, is scheduled to hold its first hearing next week, where it is expected to hear from law enforcement officials who were assaulted by supporters of President Donald Trump during the incident. At least three rockets landed near the presidential palace in Afghanistan on Tuesday. The Associated Press reported that the rockets hit shortly before Afghan President Ashraf Ghani was set to deliver a speech to commemorate the Muslim holiday of Eid. No injuries were reported. Later in the day, State Department spokesman Ned Price took questions on the continued efforts to withdraw troops from Afghanistan and the status of those Afghanis and their families who helped the U.S. military during their time there.
What I can say now is that when we do relocate these individuals to a location outside of the United States, it will be to a location that is safe and from where they can await their visa decision. Every location we're considering is appropriate and will be appropriate to keep these families safe, secure, and well cared for. As you know, we have engaged in discussions with a number of countries. Those discussions are ongoing, so I'm not in a position to preview plans for this contingent, but consistent with the safety and security of these applicants, we will reveal additional details as we're
able. That relocation happen before the end of August when the president says that the withdrawal will be complete?
So I don't have a time frame for you there, but what I will, again, emphasize is that the president said that these relocation flights will begin this month. And so we certainly expect relocation to the United States for that first group of applicants who have cleared that rigorous security vetting procedure to start later this month. I think the other point, though, is that we will maintain a diplomatic presence on the ground in Afghanistan. So just as we will continue to move as expeditiously as possible in the processing of SIV applicants at every stage of the process, this opportunity, this program will not come to an end with the withdrawal of the U.S. military from Afghanistan in the coming weeks. We will maintain that diplomatic presence precisely so that we can continue to support the Afghan people, and we have done that.
State Department spokesman Ned Price earlier today. Finally, the ultimate Amazon Prime delivery as Amazon founder Jeff Bezos blasted off into space.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. Command engine start. 2, 1. Ignition. We have lift off.
Moments after returning from the edge of space, Jeff Bezos thanked the Blue Origin team that made his flight possible. He also thanked the Texas town of Van Horn, which hosted Tuesday's launch. Here's Jeff Bezos.
Jeff, what was it like? Was everything you imagined?
I'm going to answer that question, but just real quick.
Please.
I want to thank a few people. First of all of the engineers at Blue Origin who have toiled hard to get this done, the people who build the vehicle, all of our manufacturing people. This is a big team. They've been working on it for many years, and they have done an extraordinary job of building the most reliable, most beautiful, most fun, I mean, I can vouch for that, I'll get to that in a second, vehicle. And we owe them a deep gratitude. And the people who kept us safe today, who operated the vehicle, our trainers, everybody. It's just huge. I also want to thank the town of Van Horn. This is a small and amazing little town. We're making a dent in it. And we appreciate you for allowing us to be part of your town. And then I want to thank every Amazon employee and every Amazon customer, because you guys paid for all of this. So seriously, for every Amazon customer out there and every Amazon employee, thank you from the bottom of my heart very much. It's very appreciated.
Jeff Bezos earlier today. Now, according to NPR, in the video, Bezos's comment appears earnest and elicits chuckles from the press conference audience. But as the Earth's wealthiest person, a centibillionaire of extreme proportions worth over $200 billion, the man has been under an intense microscope for his attitudes towards America's gaping wealth divide. You can read more at npr.org. A reminder that all of our coverage is online anytime at cspan.org. And if you missed any part of this program, you can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba in Washington, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.